another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, or Dr. Eugene Zamperone, and I'm glad to be here for this edition of the program right here on Progressive Radio Network. And, we have some interesting things that we're doing, myself and the natural nurse, Dr. Kamai, like our Chinatown, New York City walks coming up October 21st, so you can, if you're interested in joining us, you can find more information at naturalnurse.com, and also our trip to the West Indies is fast approaching, our ethnobotany trip, and that's in March, so again, more information on that website. But to get to the agenda today, we have Dr. Eric Ding on our program, and he's going to be talking about current research in natural medicine, including flavonoid-rich cocoa and, you know, many things like that. And now, Dr. Ding was born in China and raised in the United States. He went to Johns Hopkins University. He graduated with honors in public health, and then he earned a dual doctorate in epidemiology and nutrition from Harvard. He's an epidemiologist, nutritionist, faculty scientist at Harvard School of Public Health, also founder and director of the Campaign for Cancer Prevention. So we want to talk to him about that. He was also noted for leading a two-year-long investigation into the controversial drug Vioxx that, of course, eventually led to that medication being looked at very critically and, I believe, banned. He also is published in JAMA and many other journals, and his research is focused on risk factors and prevention of disease, also social media and health. Well published in many journals. We'll get out his website in a bit of time, but we want to welcome him to the show. Dr. Ding, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for the introduction.
Nice to have you. Great. Well, listen, let's talk a little bit about what some of the cutting-edge epidemiological things you found out about healthy foods and nutrition. Give our listeners stuff that's on the cutting edge that you're reviewing right now.
Well, there's many things that's actually changing in nutrition over time. Like back in the day, we thought, you know, butter was bad, and hence you should have margarine, but that turned out to be very false, and hence, which led to New York City banning trans fat, because trans fat and margarine is actually even worse for health. And similarly, as you know, in New York, with the sugar-sweetened beverage ban over 16 ounces, that's also on the cutting edge. Mm-hmm. And it's not just, for example, like the sugary beverages causing obesity, but it also causes you to overeat many other things. So that overeating property of sugary beverages has actually been overlooked in all the citywide debate.
So what does it trigger? What does that trigger in the body? Does it have to do with leptins? Maybe you can outline what's going on with it.
Yeah, it's a combination of various appetite hormones, but basically it's because it's liquid sugar. Because if you eat bread or if you eat any food, you feel full and you eat less later. But the problem with, for example, sugary beverages is that because it's liquid sugar, your body doesn't sense it. It's like it's partly invisible to the body. So it's hence it causes, leads to overeating because it's metabolically poisonous and leads to this invisible property. So that's why there's like all these little nuances. You know, it's not just extra calories, because technically you can get fat off of anything, including eating healthy avocados if you ate too many of them.
Right.
But it's this liquid sugar phenomenon that causes overeating. It's really bad, but it's not well known.
So, you know, all sugar, I guess, in its forms has, you know, interesting effects on the body. You know, even I remember reading, I forgot what journal it was in, but it was published in the 70s, and they showed that basically sugar in all forms, juice, any of these refined carbohydrates, even honey and maple syrup, causes a depression in phagocytosis in your neutrophils, and that lasts for X amount of time after the ingestion of this sugar. So, you know, if people are doing this all the time, it also can lead to, I guess, problems with their immune system and things like that.
Yeah. So, like, sugar-sweetened beverages also related to inflammation, which is related to your neutrophils and phagocytes and whatnot. So it has many properties. It causes the inflammation as well as all the other. So it's bad in multiple ways, you know. Yeah. And we're discovering more and more ways that it's bad. So, and at the same time, there are many nutrients that we're discovering that it's actually good in more and more ways. For example, with cocoa. Now, I wanted to first stress it's not chocolate bars per se, but like, for example, the cocoa flavonoids. These are micronutrients in cocoa. And these actually are very striking because most recently in our research, we found that cocoa flavonoids can actually lower blood pressure, lower your bad LDL cholesterol, raise your good HDL cholesterol, lower insulin resistance, improve your insulin sensitivity against, which helps prevent diabetes, and as well as improve blood flow, what we call flow-mediated dilation. And so altogether, like, it affects multiple things that we're discovering, and more things we're discovering over time. And these, this is like a recent paper we published. It was actually two Harvard papers back-to-back and several other groups.
What's the reference on that? Because it turns out this weekend I'm doing a integrated medicine evidence-based workshop.
It's our paper. It was in Journal of Nutrition.
Journal of Nutrition.
My other colleagues were in American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. But there's several other major papers recently that show that eating chocolate can prevent heart disease and strokes, and so it's become quite, all the evidence is aligning quite nicely. Mm-hmm. And these are experimental studies that we found for all this blood pressure, cholesterol, insulin resistance, blood flow results. So
now, what are people sweetening this with, Dr. Ding?
So the interesting thing is all these results are actually comparing high flavonoid cocoa versus low flavonoid cocoa or white. Because there's no sugar in these studies. So that's why I want to separate it from chocolate bars per se, because chocolate bars, you're adding in the effects of these flavonoids plus calories, fat, and sugar. So this is why it's not a, like, this is not a all-you-can-eat free pass for chocolate bars. And even then, there's many different kinds. There's milk chocolate, which has relatively little, and then dark chocolate. And then there's really bitter dark chocolate with very high cocoa flavonoids.
So that's what people should look for, the dark chocolate. But my question was, what can manufacturers that you think epidemiologically make sense, what could they sweeten the chocolate with? Do they use xylitol, or is that really bad? Do they use a little stevia? Do they use...
These sweeteners, so there's lots of manufacturing issues, which I'm not as familiar with.
Okay.
But these sweeteners, I generally think, you know, first of all, the science around these sweeteners, they haven't really proven it beyond a doubt that they actually cause cancer. If anything, they did some studies in mice, but they gave you the equivalent of eating a whole sack of sugar a day, equivalent body weight for you every single day of your life, and no one eats that much.
Mm-hmm.
All these like labels that cause tumors, they were actually removed many years ago when they realized it doesn't make sense, and there's no actual evidence that causes cancer or anything like that. But for these cocoa things, the issue is we have to be careful also that the results are basically equivalent. The dose that we were tested in all these studies were basically around the equivalent 8 dark chocolate bars a day or 30 milk chocolate bars a day. So it's not like we're actually, I'm a nutritionist, I would never recommend anyone eat, you know, that many bars of chocolate a day. And so... So the issue is, you know, how do we get enough of it without causing you to binge on chocolate and gain weight? Because the results are actually, you know, separate of actually the calories, because calories will wipe away all the benefits.
Yeah.
So the issue, I guess, you know, the two ways are basically you have to get it from some sort of dry powder or some sort of supplement.
Right. So they might be on the verge of making those things more available.
Well,
I know that
they are like, yeah. Some corporations already have them, like, you know, there's Cocovia, you know, I'm not paid.
Sure, I understand.
All
and
my
we're
research is all independent.
So, but yeah, we really can't.
Cocoa Well, but there's they are available out there, but
right.
it just you know, I'm just focusing on the science.
Okay, yeah, that's really interesting. Now, what about you had mentioned that one of the things that you love to talk about is the other healthy, the healthiest foods that, that people should be putting on their plate on a regular basis. I mean, we read about, and I want you also to talk about the ORAC value of some of these antioxidant things that we read out there. We read about acai, and we read about loganberry and wolfberry, and then cocoa, of course, having a tremendous ORAC value. But let's talk about your top foods for our listeners out there.
I think the top foods are, there's top good foods. Obviously, eat your fruits and vegetables, but most specifically, eat your cruciferous ones, which are like a broccoli and cauliflower varieties. They prevent heart disease and diabetes and maybe certain forms of cancer. But in general, fruits and vegetables and cancer is a little more uncertain. But they're really good in preventing heart disease, stroke, and diabetes. Whole grains are wonderful. And actually, the most interesting, here's an interesting backstory. The number one whole grain in the American diet is actually popcorn, which is interesting and sad at the same time because, you know, where do you mostly consume popcorn with lots of butter with movie theaters? But at the same time, it's whole grains, you know, whole grain breads, they're actually incredible in against preventing heart disease and diabetes and strokes. So those are actually really great. And, you know, in terms of, again, bad foods to avoid, the sugary beverages, avoid the red meats, because red meats in general cause diabetes, heart disease as well, and colon cancer.
So even if they're grass-fed, I mean, I think that there's
debated. So you don't actually have enough research on the grass-fed versus corn-fed phenomenon. Like, I do believe grass-fed may be healthier, but in general, red meat per se, you know, there's... It's not the grass that would change these constituents in red meat per se that much. So in general, red meat, you know, it's still, you know,
because
we have results.
I heard that the grass makes a big difference in the fat content of the meat, because if they're eating a lot of grass is like very similar to how salmon are spending their time eating, you know, smaller fish, which are loaded with omega-3s.
The only thing is, the only issue is that actually fats, the results around fat has changed.
Mm-hmm.
There's good fats and bad fats, just like there are good carbs and bad carbs.
Right.
And, you know, the whole grains are good carbs. But with the good fats are polyunsaturated and monounsaturated. And actually, meats have a lot of monounsaturated fats. And even saturated fat, we already know trans fat is bad, but even saturated fat is actually becoming more and more controversial whether it's really, really that bad. But I think it is bad because in compared to what you could use, like there's lots of saturated fat in butter, but butter is not the healthiest thing to cook with. You know, using olive oil and canola oil is actually much better. So these kind of oil... It's all about what you substitute in nutrition. Because at the end of the day, you want to eat your average 2,000, 2,500 calories so you feel full. But you have to know what is the healthiest thing, what is the healthiest way to get there. And that's actually the focus of nutrition. Because everyone has to eat, and everyone has to get there until they are full. So how do you substitute healthier, unhealthier things? So red meat's not terrible if you compare it to... You know, drinking all those 500 calories or 1,000 calories of alcohol, but red meat is not as healthy as, say, if you use turkey or chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's all about relative, because at the end of the day, we still have to eat. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So you know, now as opposed to like these grass-fed, corn-fed, the science is actually not out there for long-term human risk of various cancers and heart disease. Because, you know, just because we see it in a Petri dish, we don't really know if it actually translates into, you know, you getting heart disease 10 years down the road. So nutrition science is always evolving, and we're always learning a little more every day.
What are some of the biggest epidemiological studies that you've encountered that you know, make a huge social comment on nutrients mm-hmm. in the diet and disease prevention. Like, I've heard about the China study and big
yeah, the China
studies
study
like this.
Is, the China study was a long study, but its sample size was actually relatively small. Mm. And the diets that was collected wasn't updated over time because, honestly, you know, you don't always eat watermelons a year-round, and just the same as you don't always eat clementines year-round. So
right.
you have to get these updated. And what you eat when you're 20s is very different from what you eat if it's for someone in their 40s and someone in their 60s. So you have to get a really updated diet. The most famous study is actually the Harvard's Nurses Health Study. And it's been going on since 1970s. And we've been basically following literally a quarter million women across the United States for the past 20, 30 years.
Including
and
my wife,
there,
by the way. My wife's a nurse, and so she's involved
wonderful.
In it, too. Yeah.
She might be one of them.
She is.
So wonderful. That's fantastic. So it's actually coordinated out of our center at Harvard, and almost all the nutrition research, all the trans fat research, all the sugar-sweetened beverage research, a lot of it originated out of the Nurses' Health Study. So, for example, a trans fat ban that, you know, the Bloomberg administration imposed a few years ago, it was actually because of all the research regarding trans fat that's emerged in the past 15 years, 20 years, from the Nurses' Health Study. And it's one of the largest in the world. So basically, I would bet like seven or eight out of 10 times when you hear some sort of big nutrition finding on the news, it's actually from the Harvard Nurses' Health Study or one of our sister studies.
Now, I know we're not here to trash professions and whatnot, but how come the average diet that's given in the hospitals is so terrible compared to what you're telling us? Like, you're telling us that food can be medicine, can really help change things. So why aren't we giving cocoa flavonoids to our patients instead of Lipitor? Why aren't we doing these, and this might be political commentary, but why hasn't this percolated down into what governs the dietitian's practice in the hospitals and things like that? Why is it happening?
I think we're touching on many issues here. First of all, supplements are just an adjunct to your diet. It's mm-hmm. It's not the main the key thing day in and day out is to eat healthy rather than popping pills and eating crap junk food.
Right.
You know, because if you pop supplements all the time and eat junk food, it won't solve anything. So it's an adjunct to improving your life, but it's not the mainstay for healthy dietary health. Second of all, in the hospitals, oftentimes they have cost restrictions, and you know, hospitals, they have to cater to a very it's a very sickly population for those who basically eat hospital food. And although I do agree hospitals should take out these fast food restaurants and unhealthy kind of cantinas from their hospitals and improve their cafeterias, but there's lots of other, you know, economic issues at stake.
Right.
But as for the greater movement, the political thing, as you say, you know, I think it's actually coming around. You know, Michelle Obama she's not trying to tout a Democratic or any, you know, liberal versus conservative diet. There's, you know, health is health.
Right.
It's nonpartisan. And we're starting to realize that the cost of ill diets on American health is huge, because the cost of diabetes, cost of stroke, high blood pressure, high cholesterol is actually quite enormous if you actually think about it. Like, and the cost of obesity on top of that. So all these unhealthy foods actually do add, you know, billions, if not, you know, trillions over 10 years to the American healthcare budget, and people are starting to come around to that. The only thing is, you can't make money on the scale of Lipitor manufacturers as a broccoli manufacturer.
You know,
obviously, foods, grocery stores, and food manufacturers selling broccoli can't make this profit margin they do with these various drugs. And these various drugs, you know, most of them are just treating disease, after you get high cholesterol, after you get diabetes, what we really need to do is focus on prevention. And healthy nutrition and exercise and not smoking are the cornerstones of prevention. And just like what they say, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. It literally is. An ounce of prevention and teaching people, teaching our kids how to eat healthy would really translate into billions of cost savings for our society.
If
it's way more efficient than Lipitor or taking any pharmaceutical drug.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're interviewing Dr. Eric Ding, and he is a wonderful nutritionist and epidemiologist here. He has a dual doctorate in epidemiology and nutrition from Harvard, and we're talking about, you know, current trends in nutritional medicine, how it influences food choices in America, how it influences policy, and many issues like that. So wanted to talk, tell us a little bit about what foods you think people should, I mean, one of the big problems is breakfast. For instance, like many times I just have patients eat leftovers from supper because it's often more healthy than the average American breakfast or what many people throw a Pop-Tart in the thing and belt down a thing of coffee and they're off to the office. That doesn't sound like or they visit one of these chains, which we'll leave unnamed, and they grab a donut and some things like this. This seems to be habit and convenient, and part of medicine as a physician myself is trying to encourage healthy habits and give people tips on what they can do for breakfast that's a quick breakfast. If people have time poverty, then they got to do things fast. We're not going to change that. We live in a society that's kind of like that. It would be great if we could all stay home and make buckwheat pancakes and, you know, serve it all to our family and hang out, you know, and have a nice breakfast, like on, i.e. on a Sunday. But the reality is people are getting up. They got to be at work, fight traffic, and things like that. So what are, as a nutritionist, what are some practical things that you can tell people to start their day, and how important is breakfast?
So breakfast, you know, they actually, for children, they've actually had lots of studies that, you know, breakfast improves, you know, cognitive function in children and later in the day, the higher test scores. And eating breakfast, they've actually shown that if you eat good healthy breakfast, you tend to not overeat in the rest of the day. But again, breakfast, the definition of breakfast is very different depending on where you are in the country. You know, some people have really lots of fried hash, grits and bacon and sausages for breakfast. And that's very different from those who have the oatmeals, and especially the steel-cut oatmeals. So, again, it's all relative. I would say cut out, occasionally have an egg or two, but cut out the red meats. And cut out the high-fat, you know, these kind of pancakes and morning pastries for the most part. Oatmeal is good, although steel-cut oatmeal is better than instant oatmeal, which are really high in glycemic index and glycemic load, which really challenges your body's glucose and diabetes risk. So, though it's a spectrum, you know, in terms of what you should eat. You know, fruits and vegetables, obviously it sounds boring, but, you know, morning fruits and morning yogurt and oatmeal and granola are really great. Like, an easy thing to whip up is have some plain yogurt, because lots of yogurt these days are really sugary. So try to go with plain yogurt and put some granola or grape nuts or these kind of oats kind of things into a dish, and they're actually quite delicious, and add some fruit. And those can be done on the fly. You don't have to, you know, prepare and whip up a storm in the kitchen for.
Right.
And I think those are much more sensible. But for the most part, when I said, you know, children eating breakfast have better cognition the rest of the day, you know, I'm not talking about pancakes and bacon and bacons and, you know, sausages or anything like that. I'm talking about these sensible, healthy breakfasts. And sensible does not have to be, you know, steel-cut oats that you boil for half an hour before you can eat them. So I feel like these generally high grain and yogurts are really, really fast and efficient. And finally, for coffee, actually, coffee is actually what we've been shown from our nurses' health study at Harvard and many other studies around the world that it prevents diabetes and prevents colon cancer. So I think coffee in general is actually quite healthy of a morning health food in a way.
Well, that's pretty controversial, but that's why we're here. But, you know, I don't know if, you know, there's a lot of addictive properties, and, of course, it's on the other side, it's a roasted. So whenever you roast things, you create, you know, aromatic compounds. So I don't know if all that's taken into consideration.
We found that it doesn't matter if it's instant coffee or fresh brewed coffee, because it's actually some constituent of the coffee, and it's not the caffeine at all. So we've actually done coffee trials, and we've actually, you know, this is not a single study. Whenever I cite one of these results that I tell listeners, it's from basically dozens and dozens and dozens of study involving, you know, hundreds of thousands of people over decades. Mm-hmm. All these research are not just from, you know, one mere a paper that says this, but 10 other contradictory. No, these are all like very, very consistent results for diabetes prevention and for colon cancer prevention.
Yeah, and I think, like you said, it depends. If a person is very, you know, they have arrhythmias and they're nervous to begin with, I wouldn't tell my patient to drink coffee, even if it did help colon cancer. I would rather give them, add extra flax seeds to their yogurt and do other well-looked-at things. You know what I'm saying? So,
I agree. It really depends
on the patient.
You know, obviously, you know, we're not in a clinical setting to tailor to every patient, but we're trying to give a wide swath. And for the majority of people out there, and, you know, biology-wise, you know, more humans, it prevents diabetes and colon cancer, and it's been well-established in many JAMA papers and whatnot.
Now, what about tea? And, you know, there's got to be a lot of research on tea.
There is lots of research on tea. So the only thing is there's black tea and there's green tea. And those, the story actually becomes more interesting. Green tea, there's lots of interesting results that green tea may prevent cardiovascular mortality. But black tea, it's been a little more mixed. So I think the jury is still out on the black tea per se. But in general, tea, because here's my perspective on tea. If we could culturally shift our population from drinking sodas to tea, that would be excellent. Because here's the relative thing. When people go out to restaurants, oftentimes people order regular Coke. Now, Diet Coke is not as terrible. And given the choices, if we had a Diet Coke there, it would be much better than regular Coke. But still, you know, these kind of soft drinks have lots of, you know, acid and that leaches our bones, whatnot. So they're still not healthy. So I think tea, first of all, has really great health benefits versus drinking these kind of other things. But it may also be protective, you know, the more you drink versus the less you drink. So it's all relative what we try to push people towards. And I'm pretty sure tea is healthier. I don't need research to tell me that. Well, we have research that tea is healthier than you know, full-calorie sodas and diet sodas.
Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And stay with us right here on Progressive Radio Network. And we'll be right back with the natural nurse and Dr. Z and our wonderful guest, Dr. Eric Ding. And half hour of the natural nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, and Dr. Kamai, the natural nurse, has the week off, and we're interviewing Dr. Eric Ding, who has a dual doctorate in epidemiology and nutrition from Harvard, and he is a faculty science at Harvard School of Public Health. And we're talking about epidemiology and various trends that seem to be very appropriate for this time when we are... Dr. Ding, where does America fall in the health of the world compared to other countries?
Well, that's actually a very troubling question, because I think the United States, in many ways, you know, I think it's slipping in terms of the relative health. Let's avoid, you know, health, you know, insurance issues per se, because that's actually woefully problematic in terms of people getting health care. But in terms of actual healthy lifestyle, this is very troubling because, you know, many countries, like, let's compare it to our OECD, Western Europe type of peers, you know, their actual longevity has been increasing in many of these countries. But in contrast, in the United States, you know, there's actually research that shows that, you know, children born now may potentially be living shorter than our parents, especially among low income and lower educated individuals. And that's mostly attributed to poor obesity rates and utterly woefully poor dietary habits of these individuals. Now, at the same time, is it their fault? It's complicated, because think about it. Fruits and vegetables have outpaced the consumer price index by almost double the rate. But meanwhile, things like sugar-sweetened beverages have fallen, you know, behind the inflation, has increased slower than inflation. So when it comes to, and you know, Americans are going through a lot of tough times these days. So when they're choosing foods, you know, cheap food is very energy dense. You can get a lot of money for, you know, 99 cents at a fast food restaurant. Meanwhile, 99 cents, if you bought that amount of broccoli, you wouldn't really get very far calorically to fill your stomach. So it's we have this perverse situation where, you know, as America is in a recession, as Americans are getting more obese, what happens is the health, the general healthy state, you know, even before you get this, the disease risk propensity is really high for a lot of Americans. And it's, and you know, just like there's a income disparity that's growing, there's also a health disparity that's growing, that those who can't afford it become wealthier and healthier, but those who can't afford it become, you know, poorer and sicker at the same time. So it's just like with widening income, widening health disparity is quite troubling in the United States.
I comment that all the time on my, not only on my show, but amongst my students. I'm a professor, and it's a shame that many types of alternative medicine and healing have, because i.e. some of them aren't covered by insurance, many times supplements aren't, but now, like you said, even healthier food is tough to come by. You know, I was in New York in the inner city in the Bronx recently, and I could not find a grocery store where I was that had any healthy food. I was in
exactly
these
and
tiny
there's something
little
called a food desert as well. The food desert phenomenon within inner cities, that, you know, Whole Foods is not going to put as many stores in these parts of Bronx as they would in, you know, certain other yuppie kind of communities.
Right,
which is not a fault of Whole Foods per se. It's an economic issue, but the access to healthy foods, affordable healthy foods, is just woefully deficient in some of these inner city communities, as well as in the Deep South, as well. So it's quite pervasive everywhere.
And you know, that's why I'm a big fan of like local, trying to encourage local education. I'm a member of NOFA, the Organic Farming Association, and oftentimes there are many projects where we'll go into the inner city and start community gardens and things like that. And, you know, we understand that, you know, the soil may have heavy metals and there may be problems with it, but, you know, when we try to correct for many of these inner city issues, I think the people will still come out ahead if they can. If we could change society, because that's a big societal thing, that's a big epidemiological issue. It's an industrial farming issue, and things like that. It really touches many levels of our society.
Yeah, and the equal access, whether it's equal access to health care or equal access to healthy foods, and equal access to even groceries to get the healthy foods, there's huge economic disparities.
But you mentioned around the world that many folks can just spot Americans coming their way because of their body mass index. Talk about what the body mass index is, why it's an important parameter of health.
Is a metric of your weight divided by your height squared. And what basically is a measure of general body size and adiposity. Obviously, there are some people who claim that, you know, body mass index, well, you could just be really muscular and have a high BMI.
Mm-hmm.
True. But for the most part, how many bodybuilders do we see every day? And I did a study several years ago among professional athletes, among baseball players across 130 years. And among these, though, who debuted into the major league with higher body mass index, it would stand for greater muscle mass among these professional athletes. But higher body mass index still predicted greater mortality risk.
Hmm.
So in the general population and apparently among baseball players, it's also predictive of risk of death, risk of diabetes, risk of heart disease. It's actually one of the strongest risk factors. Now, there is a controversy. Some people say, well, overweight is better than normal weight. Well, that's not true, because what happens, you hear this a lot. I read an op-ed in the Times that got this wrong, that, you know, being overweight, being normal weight is dangerous. Well, that's because smokers oftentimes are leaner, but smokers are much more unhealthier, and hence there's lots of bias in terms of that. But aside from these, a greater body mass index in general means greater risk of diabetes, heart disease, stroke, cancers, and general mortality. So that's why it's quite striking. But in the United States, for example, one-third of Americans are overweight, two-thirds are obese or overweight. But in many other countries, for example, that ratio is like one-fifth, one-sixth, that's obese in any ways. So the disparity is quite shocking in many ways. So, and this obesity is oftentimes related to, you know, sedentary activities and diets, like high sugary soda beverages that we drink every day.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a big trend that happened, or a big shift, maybe is a better word, that when people saw the body mass index increase after we went to low fat, because when fat was vilified, like kind of you were pointing out in the first part of our program, I guess manufacturers spiked everything with extra sugar. And I think I don't know if this...
That was actually bad, because that was back in the day, remember how the old food pyramid, all the fats were at the top of the food pyramid of the things to avoid. But since then, we've learned that there are good fats and bad fats. And just like carbs that were at the base of the pyramid, there are good carbs and bad carbs. And what happened is we cut out all the good fats, and we basically loaded up people on carbs, because you still have to gain all your calories on a certain day to get full. And so, for example, things like mayonnaise are actually quite healthy. I know there are probably people just gasp out there. But
yeah, people are falling out of their chairs with that comment.
I know, but because for the most part, mayonnaise is very high in the polyunsaturated and monounsaturated fats, and we actually show that high mayonnaise consumption is associated with lower risk heart disease. Very ironic.
Wow.
But at the same time, you know, these kind of like results, they are clearly pointing to the fact that there are good fats. And no one ever published the thing that eating butter prevents heart disease. You know, no one, if anything, it goes the other way. But at the same time, like these carbs, here's a typical scenario. If you tell people to avoid fat, what do they eat? They eat more carb kind of foods, which are oftentimes white bread. Very few people actually would cut out all their fats and substitute everything with whole grains, because whole grains are still relative minority. They eat, load up them, you know, non-whole grain pastas and many other white rice, as opposed to brown rice and whole wheat pastas and whole grain breads. You know, and hence that actually loads up on actually even worse foods. So saturated fat, some people say it's not as bad. Well, it's not as bad compared to the white bread and, you know, and white rice and white pasta that we eat. So it's all relative. What you really want is the whole grains and the browns, rices, and these kind of foods that people are really usually very, you know, very unwilling to go out of their way to order those kind of things, especially at restaurants.
Right. So fiber makes, so fiber, there's clearly a big link with fiber and less incidence of morbidity.
Yeah, so it's oftentimes the fiber in these whole grain foods that associate with lower risk of diabetes, heart disease, and strokes. But at the same time, it's not just the fiber. Whole grains also have lots of important micronutrients like magnesium, potassium. Potassium lowers your blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Magnesium also lowers your blood sugar a little bit, may also slightly prevent heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
And also the calcium and many nutrients that are just when you create white bread or white flour, you completely discard all these nutrients that's in the bran. And so, you know, this is why whole grains have multiple reasons, not just the fiber in it, but also these micronutrients that are completely being washed out.
I mean, I think the listeners are pretty aware of that. But what they may not be aware of is there any pretty good solid epidemiological research on some of these minerals and their
effect
on
the
decrease?
So whenever I say these prevents disease, like potassium, so we know that there's lots of studies that on dietary potassium lowering heart disease risk, and dietary calcium lowering heart disease and diabetes risk, and alongside with calcium, oftentimes more calcium also increases your vitamin D from other sources. So vitamin D, which also prevents diabetes, heart disease, and colon cancer, and maybe breast cancer at high doses. So there's lots of evidence for these beneficial effects. Of course, also bone for vitamin D. And magnesium, similarly, there's some research that it prevents diabetes, even among pregnant women as well, and against heart disease. So all these, when I say these studies, I don't just mean one or two studies.
Right.
I mean multitudes upon multitudes of studies.
Well, that's the whole thing, because if you know, some of the naysayers, they point to a like, you know, the vitamin E study or the beta carotene study. What was wrong with those studies in that they, you know, of course the news gets hold of this and puts it out, oh, vitamin E is bad, it causes cancer and things.
Well,
what was going on with
vitamin
that?
Vitamin E is actually very interesting because in the old days there were some, not every study was built the same. There were some good and bad studies. A lot of the early vitamin E and vitamin C studies were poorly done or a very small sample size, and they turned out to be wrong in these large randomized trials. And, you know, I don't think vitamin E causes anything terrible, per se, or same for vitamin C. But, you know, for example, we discovered that beta-carotene actually causes lung cancer in smokers, but maybe because it feeds the cancer that's already in these smokers. But oftentimes, they don't pan out. But a lot of the things have. And it's a confluence of evidence. It's not a single study. So I do something called meta-analysis. And systematic reviews and meta-analysis are the best way to go because they take all the evidence. They don't just cherry-pick one study here or there. They take all the evidence and then summarize them. And if all the evidence seems to agree in the same direction, then you make a stronger conclusion, as opposed to a one study here and there that it's almost like a roulette wheel, a news roulette wheel that sometimes you hear. One week you'll say this, but 1 week you'll say that. Focus your attention on these large meta-analysis that synthesizes all the research across all the studies.
Yeah, that's very important because it confuses the heck out of listeners and the public. They read one thing, the next thing they hear this, that this is bad for them, and they're very confused,
well,
so they say, what the heck, I'm just going to drink
scientists
soda.
Scientists like to self-promote as well. So this is what happens where everyone wants to self-promote their research a little bit, and there's this tendency to sensationalize and overhype some of their studies.
Right.
For example, a few weeks ago, a few months ago, there was a study that, you know, someone claimed that eating chocolate can cause weight loss. And it's it was reported the world around. You know how the media loves kind of those kind of articles.
Yeah.
But it was woefully terrible small study. It was woefully poorly conducted. And no one in the scientific community takes it seriously. But in the news, it gets picked up because it's a hot topic. So I feel like sometimes, you know, nothing against journalists out there. I feel like sometimes poorly conducted journalism or bad journalism is just as dangerous for public health as bad science.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like there's a communication barrier in hyping, you know, in promotion over hyping phenomenon sometimes happening.
So you would agree then that you know, with these, for instance, these antioxidant studies, that it's very important to get a blend of many antioxidants which you'd find in the whole mm-hmm. food versus single antioxidants because of the redox reactions in our body that we need kind of a whole.
So antioxidants is a very broad class. I would say antioxidants, it's not the oxidation properties per se. For example, cocoa flavonoids are actually good, but I don't think it's the antioxidant properties per se, because there's many flavonoids, and many flavonoids don't have any demonstrated effects, but cocoa flavonoids do. So it's a very small, and it's such a broad class, because vitamin E is an antioxidant class. Vitamin C is.
Right. Selenium, that's a mineral. Yeah.
So I don't think we should just base it on antioxidants per se, because that kind of hypothesis hasn't really panned out. I think there's each of these micronutrients are very, very different. And I think we should focus on the specific properties of each, because the antioxidants in tea and berries is not the same as cocoa. And I wouldn't try to compare them. They are apples and oranges, literally, in many ways, that you can't really compare them. And so you mentioned the ORAC score before.
Yeah.
The ORAC score is interesting, but the thing is the ORAC score itself hasn't been demonstrated into actual long-term risk. It's been demonstrated, it helps cell healing in a petri dish here and there, but it doesn't really, I'm not saying it's not effective. I'm just saying it hasn't really been proven beyond a shadow of doubt that it really predicts greater or lower risk of death than disease in the long term in these 20, 30-year studies.
Yeah, but this is where we look at, you know, I'm an ethnobotanist, too, and we visit different cultures who have used, you know, these foods for a very long time, and this is where we get our ideas of what to study for. So when we look at people using...
No, I agree. There's lots of benefits to ethnobotany.
Yeah.
For example, a lot of cocoa research emerged from these Kuna Indians off the coast of Panama.
Right.
And most of us have increasing blood pressure over generations, while these Kunas basically have absolutely zero blood pressure increase across the entire lifespan. And but at the same time, you know, so we from there, they drink like liters of cocoa a day. So we learned that maybe cocoa may be beneficial, and it's really good to study them. But at the same time, you know, there's other populations with vastly different diet. These people basically are have very different levels of physical activity, very different levels of sunlight and vitamin D. There's many other things that are very tricky to say, they must do it, and therefore it must be good.
It must be hard,
really hard.
In your research to, you know, cull out these, because things are so, you know, health is so complex. It's mind, body, spirit.
And
so
you need, like, long-term studies that, you know, collect detailed information on everyone across 20, 30 years. And that's what, like, our Harvard Nurses Health Study has collected across these years. Starting in 1980, every year, every 2 years, we collected all these dietary data. We have blood data from dating back 20 years. And all these dietary data are updated every year, every other year. And it's quite detailed. And if they change diets because they get sick, there's lots of non-causal kind of phenomenon happening that we tease out. But we have literally massive vaults of these data, of gigabytes of these data from all these people over the decades. This is what we do as epidemiologists. We study disease risk patterns and causal patterns. We study causation in human populations.
So we're running out of time.
It can be done.
Running out of time, Dr. Ding. You want to leave us with a couple of really good pearls that we didn't talk about, anything that you wanted to really discuss? And also, you know, if people want to get in touch with you, feel free to give out
sure.
your website.
They can, visit my website is ericding.org. It forwards to my Harvard website. You can learn more and contact me if you wish. At the same time, I think what's more important, we know 90% of diabetes and heart disease can be prevented. What needs to be done is translating that. And I think translating that into prevention can ultimately yield billions of dollars in healthcare savings.
So it, has to translate into behavior, like, okay,
exactly.
What does a non-diabetic person do in their life that a diabetic person does not do,
actually,
or vice versa?
I also work with an organization called Microclinic International, microclinics.org, and we actually try to leverage that into doing social network interventions for behavior change for obesity and diabetes prevention. And so we're launching several programs to test that right now. And I feel like social networks in leveraging behavior change is actually one of the most interesting phenomena that we can potentially do to leverage healthy behaviors.
Yeah, we need coaches. We need people to, you know, a lot of behavior is habit. And I find as a practitioner that if I can influence the patient's behavior and find, you know, sort of leverages or be able to put leverage on them to help them figure out how they change.
Indeed.
Then I could really, you know, make a big difference one-on-one with people. But it's been great to talk to you about some of these interesting trends. And I'll start getting on the Coco bandwagon, too. I like that. And, you know, it's funny when I go down to the Caribbean, we're always drinking the cocoa. It's very interesting how they pick it off the trees and process it and then pound it into the cocoa. And, you know, it's very bitter, though, so that's what I think turns many Americans off. So that's the reason why I asked you about what would be a good sweetener for it, because, you know, Americans tend to have a sweet tooth and they're not used to that bitter flavor, although the bitter flavor seems
to
be...
We want to get the benefits of cocoa without the calories, fat, and sugar. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Easier said than done, but we'll continue to work on it.
Indeed, indeed.
Dr. Ding, it's been a pleasure to have you on. I appreciate
pleasure
it.
Indeed.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Have a great one. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Remember, you can always visit our websites, naturalnurse.com and drzdrznaturally.com. Stay healthy, folks, and have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.